Welcome to Stack Trace, a show where we talk about Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. I'm Guy Rambo.
And I am John Sandell.
So, John, this week we have a bunch of cool stuff to talk about, including Dark Mode and Marzipan, which I know people are very anxious to hear us talk about. But let's start with some news about the show itself. Why don't you tell people what we're doing?
Sure. So we've been talking about this for a while, including on the last episode about, you know, how can we make this show more sustainable? How can we enable us to do it weekly? And one thing that was suggested to us was, why don't you start a Patreon? So we thought about it a lot. And, you know, last week we talked about it on the show and we also, you know, tweeted about it and asked people for feedback. And a lot of people seem to think that this is a really good idea. So we've now decided that let's do it. Let's try this. Let's see, you know, if Patreon is going to be a good thing for the show and if we will be able to reach our goal of doing the show weekly, which is something we really, really want to do because, you know, the news don't stop while we're not recording. So we would really love to be able to bring you the show every single week. But in order to be able to do that, we need, you know, a little bit of financing. And we would love to use Patreon for the show and to see, you know, how it can go. So we've set up a Patreon page. It's at patreon.com/stacktracepod. One thing that is important to note about this Patreon is that we're not going to add like any paywalls. We're not going to say, you know, oh, only every second episode is free. No, no, no. All the episodes that we're making are going to be free and available to everybody, but there will be some tiers in Patreon for you to get some rewards. We will probably add more in the future, but in the most important part of this Patreon is that we're kind of treating it a little bit like a Kickstarter to, you know, ask the community to kind of chip in a few bucks every month to help us, enable us to make this show a weekly thing. That's basically what we're doing. And we hope that you guys are excited about it and that you would love to support us doing the show. So yeah, let's see where it goes.
So yeah, we have our initial goal, which is to do the podcast weekly. But we have a special little thing planned if we reach our goal before WWDC, which is in about a month. Right, John?
Exactly. So if we hit our goal, you can go to our Patreon page to see, you know, the progress of the current goal. And if we hit that before WWDC, then we're going to do a extra long special episode right after WWDC with a big walkthrough of all the new cool APIs. You know, Rambo is going to do his spelunking and we're going to report back the findings. And we're just going to dig really deep into all the new APIs and do like a big overview. So I hope you want to help us hit that goal because we would really love to do that episode. And it's going to be pretty fun, I think.
Head over to Patreon and check out our page. And please help us do this show weekly and maybe reach our goal before WWDC.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And you can go to patreon.com/stacktracepod. And there will also be a link in the show notes. So yeah, looking forward to see where this experiment takes us.
Cool.
Awesome. So that's all the follow-up that we have for this episode. So let's go ahead now and dig into our topics. And the first one I'm really excited about, it's a new finding by you, Rambo. You have been spelunking the WebKit code and you've found some really interesting findings about the capabilities of running WebKit or Safari in a dark mode, using a dark theme. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your findings? What did you find?
Okay, so this is a tricky one to explain because it requires a bunch of knowledge of how macOS handles its UI, and we're going to dive more deeply into that in a bit. Because there isn't like a method in WebKit called switch to this new dark mode thing. Like, it's not
dark mode on
explicit. Yeah, it's not something like that. So it requires some explanation. And some people have even like said to me that it definitely doesn't mean dark mode. And I think if you read the article I posted on 9to5Mac, I explained it very clearly that this is not like a 100% confirmation that dark mode's coming. And the reason why I had this conclusion after reading that code was because the appearance system on macOS is currently used for a few things, like deciding if a window is going to have a light background or a dark background. And it also affects all controls within that window. So if you imagine your system preferences window with a bunch of buttons and pop-up menus and stuff, if you set the system preferences window to have the dark mode, like appearance that's built into macOS, it's been in existence since at least El Capitan, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
So then the entire window will get this dark appearance, and all controls within the window and the text will become white to match this new appearance. So that's what the appearance system is designed to do on the Mac. And there isn't currently a concept of a system appearance. So what does that mean? It means that there isn't, like, there is the dark menu bar and dock setting, which is there and can be used. I think it's since El Capitan that it's existed.
Yeah, I'm running it actually right now.
Yeah, I use that as well because I love dark mode.
And yeah, me too. I want it to expand. Anything I can turn dark, I'll do it.
Yeah, so it's been in existence since at least El Capitan, and what does the setting does is it changes a string property, so it's just a text that is either empty, so nothing, the default, or just dark, the word dark. That's the preference that's changed when you select that checkbox in preferences. You say, I want it dark, or I want the default, which is just nothing. And so this in Safari that I found in WebKit is different from that, because it's actually querying the NS application object, which is the object in code that represents the currently running application, so your application, and it's querying the application for its effective appearance. And the name of the properties inside WebKit is like system appearance, whether you want to use the system appearance. And that those two combined mean that this is not just knowing whether your menu bar is dark or not. It's something else. It's more than that. Is this making any sense? It's kind of tricky to explain.
Yeah, so what you're saying is basically like there's the current setting that you can use to make your dock and menu bar dark, like we are using. And then there seems to be like an upcoming second source of truth, if you will. And what Safari or WebKit is doing is taking both of these signals or this data and basically turning it into an effective, like the actual appearance that should be rendered.
Yeah, and there's like this word effective, it has a specific meaning, because the appearances on macOS, they can be combined to generate, like, you can have two appearances that are combined to generate a third appearance. It's very similar to how CSS works. If people are familiar with the web, you have a style sheet that tells how it's going to render the text and the backgrounds and stuff, and you can add other rules on top of the existing ones, and those rules are going to be combined with the previous ones to generate an effective representation of those rules. So this is what an effective appearance is. It's a combination of different settings and appearances to generate the one true appearance that's going to actually be used to render components on screen.
Exactly. So one way of kind of looking at it is that, let's say you are rendering different types of text in your app, and you want to say that all the text in my app should use this font. So I have the font setting for all labels is this font. But then you want to have different sizes, or you want to have different colors, for example. You could add more specific rules for more specific elements. For example, in CSS, like you mentioned, you could say, well, all the, you know, the entire HTML page should use the Helvetica font, but then when I have an H1, like a heading, it should be larger, for example. So you can add these rules that I get more and more specific as you kind of query your hierarchy.
Yes, and the iOS and Mac developers that are listening are probably familiar with asset catalogs. So can you explain in a simple way what asset catalogs are?
Sure. So asset catalogs are basically a way to group together all of your application's assets, whether those are images, PDF files. You can now put colors there as well, and you can put all the assets that you need, and those will be compiled into like a binary format that you can then query at runtime. So you can say, give me, in the code, you can say just like, give me an image with this name. So you will write in the code UI image named. And you don't need to worry about like which asset catalog it's in or, you know, how it's structured. iOS will automatically fetch that image for you for the right screen resolution. So if you're running on an, you know, iPhone 8 Plus, it would fetch the at 3x image, for example. Or if you're running on an older device, it will be at 2 or at 1x. So that way you can just, you know, specify the asset you want by name, but the system will give you the correct actual asset that you need.
Yeah, that was a very good explanation. And not only that, but asset catalogs, they can actually be used to define like not only the resolution of the screen. So am I running in an iPhone 8 or in an iPhone SE, which has a lower resolution display, but it can also encode other capabilities of the device, like the graphics processing capabilities, the version of Metal that runs on the device, and other aspects like is this device running in a right to left language.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff can be encoded in an asset catalog, and when an application queries for a resource, the system is going to resolve which asset should be returned. And that's a very cool aspect of asset catalogs.
Yeah.
I asked you to explain asset catalogs because those appearances on macOS, they are basically asset catalogs. That's what they are. They are a slightly different format, but they are asset catalogs. So instead of having like an image named something like intro image or my logo, it has specific images for every control in every state. So you have a button, you have the button when it's pressed, when it's disabled, when it's pulsing, when it's like the button that's going to be invoked when you press the return key. So it has all of those states in one asset catalog for every control on the system. And that's how macOS renders its UI. And they are located in system library core services system appearance.bundle. That bundle has a bunch of asset catalogs inside it. And one of those asset catalogs is the dark appearance, which is available on macOS. And apps can currently use that appearance. My WWDC app for macOS, it uses a combination of the dark appearance with a custom appearance I made with a little app of mine, which we're going to talk about in a bit. And so apps can currently already use the dark mode appearance on macOS if they want to and if they want to support it. And all of the system controls work automatically. If you use like a regular button, it's going to automatically switch between the light and dark mode appearances. And there are several apps you can get that already do that. They offer their own dark setting, and some of them use that system already. So what changed with this WebKit code is that now there is a concept of a system setting to switch between the light and dark mode appearances. And even it can be seen in that code that the effective appearance property on NS application is not available in the current macOS SDK, but it's going to be available starting with 10.14, which is the next iteration of macOS. And they have a check in the code for that.
That's really interesting, because since WebKit is an open source project, we can start seeing some of these flags already. And, you know, we see these checks for future upcoming versions of macOS. And these checks are obviously not available in the current SDK and stuff because, well, you know, those versions haven't shipped yet.
Yeah, and in fact, what I've done is I got the source code and I decided to try it out and see what it did. So I removed that version check from the code and I implemented effective appearance on NS application. This is going to be tricky to explain to non-developer people, but you can define functionality that doesn't exist in system components. You as a developer can go and implement stuff that's not currently implemented. And it's a very simple method because it just returns the current system appearance, which I guessed based on its name. So what I did was I implemented that method on an application in the context of WebKit, and I made it return the dark appearance, which, as we said, already exists. And then I compiled and ran Safari using my version of WebKit, and the web page got the dark components.
That is super cool. Isn't open source a beautiful thing?
Yeah.
It must be like the Spelunker's, you know, perfect dream to have all the source code available. You don't even have to reverse engineer anything. You just download it from GitHub and build it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not on GitHub, but it was fun to get it from the... I think I got a tar ball from like the old way of distributing open source.
Right. Old school. Yeah. Good stuff.
And just before we move into other aspects of this, I need to make it very clear that this has absolutely nothing to do with iOS.
So, right.
Maybe I think it would be kind of weird for them to launch a dark mode on the Mac, like a full dark mode on the Mac and not on iOS. But that's all I've got. Like, I've seen no evidence of an upcoming dark mode on iOS. But of course, they could be hiding it very well. And we'll see with iOS 12 next month.
Well, I wonder if we only think that it's weird because we're now so used to all the new cool features launching on iOS first. Because, you know, if we think about it, like, we're going to talk about it later, like, a little bit about... this relates to some of the pro apps and the work that Apple is doing about, like, you know, pro desktop users. Because, you know, some of these features that are more targeted towards this audience, well, this audience is primarily on the Mac. So it kind of makes sense for something like this to launch on the Mac first. But I think we've just become so used to the Mac being this platform that only kind of inherits technologies that have already been on iOS for like a year or something like that.
Yeah, I think that that's part of why we feel like it's weird for something to come to macOS, especially something so cool as dark mode. I think there's a huge demand for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think we should talk about Core UI, which is another aspect of this.
Sure.
So we mentioned asset catalogs, and the system that reads the asset catalogs for the system appearances and actually renders stuff on screen is a system called Core UI, which exists since Leopard, so 2007. And what this system does is it reads these asset catalogs and the other parts of the system, like AppKit, which is the UI framework for macOS, just builds like a dictionary, just a request. I want you to render this control in this state with these options, and then CoreUI goes ahead and renders it using the current appearance, which is set by the application. It's actually set by the thread, but that's overly complicating it for non-developer people. So that's what CoreUI does. And I was listening to last week's ATP, and Syracuse mentioned Pro Apps during the part where they talked about the dark mode stuff. And I've been looking at Final Cut Pro since they released the version 10, like spelunking Final Cut Pro. I even found that it had a XML exporting option before they actually released it. I think it was like my first discovery while spelunking.
You never forget your first discovery, right?
Yeah. So, and Pro Apps have been using this little framework, well, it's not actually little, called ProKit. So, AppKit, ProKit. And ProKit and CoreUI, they seem to have a lot in common. Almost like CoreUI was like taking ProKit and making it generic to be used for the whole system. Or maybe they were developed like together, because the first time I saw a car file, which is the extension for asset catalogs, was inside Final Cut.
Interesting.
They didn't use them for the system at the time. And the Pro Apps were already using this concept of let's define a visual style that can be applied to controls and can be combined with other visual styles. So maybe this whole thing started with the Pro Apps group at Apple.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. Do you think it might have been because, you know, one thing that usually separates Apple's Pro Apps like Logic and Final Cut from the consumer versions like GarageBand and iMovie is that the consumer versions tend to have more like a standard UI. Well, I guess that's not really true for GarageBand, which has always had this like, you know, wooden feel to it. It's like one of the last standing like skeuomorphic designs, which, you know, I actually really love GarageBand's design. I think it's, you know, it's perfect for kind of this like creative application to look like that. But anyway, do you think that it might have been because, you know, they wanted to have like a unified way to construct these more like darker, you know, pro looking UIs?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I was so obsessed with the way those apps looked, because they, even back in the day, they looked amazing, like with the dark UI. I was so obsessed with that I created my own version of ProKit, which is open source, by the way. But you should definitely not use that. Please don't.
Don't send me support.
Yeah, I made like my own little version of ProKit, which copied it in a bunch of ways and rendered that dark mode UI before it was just a matter of setting a property on your window like it is today.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it started with the Pro Apps. And another interesting aspect of this CoreUI system is that it's patented.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I guess it's one of those things where, you know, companies like Apple, they patent everything they can, right? Mostly, well, I guess it's hard to say why, but, you know, both to protect themselves, but also to, you know, preemptively patent something so they won't end up getting, you know, in trouble later when someone else patents it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So this patent, it's not specifically like linked to this system, but is a way to define graphical user interface materials in a resolution independent way. So you can imagine like when you use Photoshop, you can create like a gradient, and you can define different stops to the gradient and colors and blend modes. This patent from Apple is similar to that interface, but it's a lot more advanced. And it's basically an app. If you open the link in the show notes, you're going to see a PDF of this patent. And it has a screenshot of a button material being edited. And
oh, yeah.
It's like the classical like aqua bubble with a highlights, and it looks kind of 3D.
Yeah, so, I was just going to say that it looks almost like, you know, like a 3D engine, like you would use like a game engine like Unity or Unreal, and you would, because in 3D graphics, you are almost always working with materials, and then you're applying shaders and lighting and things to those materials. And this really, really looks like one of those windows from Unreal or one of these editors to edit one of those 3D materials. And we'll put a link in the show notes to this PDF if people want to take a look.
Yeah, and the way they describe it is like the application, it uses a recipe to tell the rendering engine to render something, and the rendering engine gives the application a bitmap, so just an image, so the application can actually display that image. And it will, of course, use the correct aspect and the resolution of the display to generate a crisp control image. And from all I can see, they actually used this system early on during Leopard, but then they like didn't use it anymore. So it's not what CoreUI ended up being, but it was a really cool idea. And it was very specific to what macOS looked like back in the day. So the bubbly looking buttons and all of the 3D looking controls. I don't think a system like that would be required today.
Right.
So today, as far as I know, all controls on the Mac, they are drawn in PSD files, so Photoshop files, and Apple is using an internal application they call Theme Edit to generate those themes that end up in the OS.
So that's actually converting like the PSD files into something that the OS can read more efficiently.
Yeah, and it actually supports not only images, but all of the stuff we know from the regular asset catalogs we as developers use, but it supports colors, fonts, materials. So the vibrant light and vibrant dark materials, they are just core animation archives, which use like system effects and stuff.
Yeah.
They also support effects. So, you know, when you have a button in a toolbar on macOS and then you select the button and it changes the color and looks like it's depressed and the icon has like a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an effect that's defined in asset catalogs as well.
Cool. So you mentioned that, you know, system like this might not be useful today, like because we have this more flat looking UI these days. We tend to build UIs that is more composed of different shapes rather than using these more, you know, rich textures and 3D effects and things like that. But one thing I think is important about systems like these and why they exist and why it's like, you know, can be a good idea to use something like this, both for Apple's use and also for us as third-party developers, it's really a lot about future-proofing. Because, you know, if every detail about the UI is being read from some configuration and it's all like, you know, derived from that, then you can just replace the configuration and the UI will change. And as long as nothing in the code is making any hard assumptions about that configuration, then things will be extremely dynamic and you'll be able to effectively move to a different design or a different look without ever updating any code. And of course, this is really, really beneficial for Apple because you know, we've seen already that, you know, when they are updating the system appearance, all the apps that are using AppKit, like, you know, just using it directly without like drawing any custom UI and things like that, they just get the new appearance straight away. And the same is true, you know, for certain aspects on iOS as well. So I think, you know, even though right now it might not seem like what's the use and this might seem, you know, even like over-engineering. And yeah, to some extent, maybe like defining like materials this way, like a 3D engine, maybe it's a little bit overkill for, you know, a button in a 2D UI. But in general, these kind of systems, I personally find very appealing and very interesting because they enable this like high level of dynamism, you know, going forward.
Yeah, and that's why Apple always tells us developers to try and use the default system stuff. And on the Mac, they are very explicit about you should use, instead of using like for the text, using black as a color, they tell you to use like the semantic color, so label color, secondary label color, because those colors, they depend on the context and they will change if your app is using the dark appearance to be white automatically, which doesn't happen if you simply use black color, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. And whenever there will be eventually, hopefully, a dark mode for iOS as well, well, we're going to see a lot of apps, I'm guessing, that don't really comply with that because they do the custom drawing. And it's going to be a very interesting kind of look and feel, I think, in the beginning, where you're going to see, you know, all the apps that are using, you know, all this derived information and using the vanilla kind of UI kit controls be updated. And all the ones that are doing custom drawing are going to kind of look out of place.
Yeah, and another thing that's available on the Mac is the accessibility appearance. And it's basically another theme that makes controls get like more contrast, so the borders are more well-defined, and it's something you can enable in accessibility settings. And this could be the reason for this change in Safari, but I don't think it is because of two reasons. First, it already works currently, so they wouldn't have to implement it. So that's one reason. And second, because all changes related to this new appearance stuff that I saw in WebKit, they have a background color property that's added as well to the related thing that's getting the system appearance.
Right.
And the accessibility stuff doesn't change background colors, but a dark mode would probably have to change background colors of things.
Yeah, because even if you would do something like invert colors on accessibility, you probably wouldn't do that as a background color. You would do that as like a post-processing phase on the entire rendered context. Like you would just invert all the colors as a final step before sending it to the GPU or even doing it on the GPU instead of doing it like as a background color.
Yeah, and the system is already doing that automatically, so
yeah,
I don't
exactly
think that's the case here. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. And another thing, I mentioned the Theme Edit app that Apple uses. I made my own, which is...
of course you did.
Yeah, which is Appearance Maker. Very clever name, very, very creative.
I like it.
So it's basically... it's a very hacky app to begin with because it uses a completely undocumented system feature.
You using undocumented system features? Really?
Yeah, that's a surprise, of course.
Big surprise.
And it breaks with almost every major release of the OS, but I've been using it here and there to like create my own appearances for buttons and controls in my apps. So if anyone out there wants to have a look, it's their Appearance Maker. And it uses a system framework that has a very clever name, Core Theme Definition. That's the name. So it's very obvious what it does.
Nice.
And I don't even know why that framework is included with the OS, to be honest, because I don't think anything uses it in the OS. So it could be something that didn't even exist in the OS and was just available to Apple internal apps or something. But hey, I'm not complaining.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So yeah, so if you're a developer of Mac apps and you want to create your own custom controls using Photoshop, you can use my Appearance Maker.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to that one. So I think what we can talk about now a little bit is, we've talked a lot now about the like technical details, you know, which is what we do on the show, but I would also love to talk a little bit about kind of why Apple might be doing something like this. And we touched a little bit about it, about, you know, pro apps and unifying the look of something like Safari and other apps with the pro apps that already use this dark appearance. But what do you think might be some like of the underlying reasons why Apple would bring something like this to macOS now?
It has a lot of demand, first of all, so that could be one of the reasons. Not that Apple is like doing everything people want, but I think they definitely listen, and it's been a really big request. And they have that pro workflow group now that's working with lots of pros. And maybe they've heard from those people that like they are working on Final Cut Pro with the dark window, and then all of a sudden they open Finder and it's a huge white window that blinds them. Yeah. And it takes a while for the eyes to adjust after that. So that could be the extent of it. Like, let's make it better for our pro users. Let's not blind them with light every time they switch applications. Popular demand is another reason.
Yeah.
I can't really think of any other reason.
So here's what I think. I'm thinking about like, why are all pro apps, I mean not all, but why are most pro apps out there, whether we're talking about, you know, game engine editors, we're talking about code editors, or you know, something like Final Cut or Logic, why are all of them like black? Is it just because it's cool, or because it has this pro looking feel?
Well, I was going to say because they're super freaking cool.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a reason to charge more, just like the black or space gray peripherals are like $20 more. It's the same reason.
Will they call
it
dark mode, or will they call it space gray mode?
Space gray mode. I love it. Definitely. Yeah, anyway, the reason I think all of these apps have the space gray look and feel to them is because you're dealing with content. And when you're dealing with content, you want to have focus on the content. When you're in Photoshop and you're editing a photo, you want the UI should kind of just disappear. It should just be in the background. And a dark looking UI usually blends in more or disappears more in the background than a light one. A light one kind of draws more attention to itself just by, you know, the pixels actually lighting up and being bright. So I think that has a lot to do with it, that, you know, if you are a person who is working with a lot of content, you know, you're an editor, or you're, you know, working with movies, or you're, you know, like us developers, when you're working with content in that way, you would love a lot of your UI to just disappear a little bit more, to become, you know, fade out into the background. And I think that's something that dark mode could help achieve.
Yeah, I agree. And even if you look at the Photos app on macOS, when you go to edit a photo, the entire app switches to a dark appearance.
There you go. Awesome. So our next big topic for this episode is some exciting new information about this alleged Marzipan framework that we've been talking about before. And just to recap a little bit, we've talked about it on the first episode of the show about a rumored new UI framework under the name Marzipan that should unify the development experiences for iOS and the Mac, so that we would be able to write apps that run on both iOS and the Mac using a similar or the same UI framework. So this is something that a lot of people in the industry and, you know, on different podcasts, blogs, and Twitter have been talking about now for months. But there's been some new information coming from John Gruber and Daring Fireball. He posted an article called Scuttlebutt Regarding Apple's Cross-Platform UI Project. And it contains some interesting new tidbits. So, Rambo, you want to walk us through kind of what's new and what we're speculating about this time?
First of all, Gruber mentions that there is, in fact, a cross-platform UI project going on at Apple, and that maybe the codename was Marzipan sometime in the past, but it's not called that anymore. And of course, he doesn't give us the actual codename, which would be cool. And he says that the name hasn't leaked yet. So that's the first part. So the Marzipan project doesn't exist, basically, because Marzipan was the name of some project, and that project is not called Marzipan anymore. So we know that there's a cross-platform UI project going on, but it's not Marzipan, and it's something else. So the more interesting part of the Gruber story is that for him, it sounds like they are working on a declarative control API. Instead of writing your code like we do today for controls, some people use Interface Builder, which is basically drag and drop. You drag objects and you lay them out on screen. What you see is what you get type of deal. Kind of like using Dreamweaver for web development back in the day. And others like myself, and I think you, John, also is on that camp. We do all of our UI in code, so you just create a button and you tell the button to be at this place on the screen, and you tell it to do this, and the title is that. So basically, you tell the system what to do, and you create objects and put them on screen using code.
And handcrafted UIs, that's what I like to call them.
Perfect. So what Gruber is saying is that they are working on a system that instead of you writing the code in this way we mentioned, you actually use something like kind of like HTML to define the button and its attributes in some way. And he even mentions React, that React could be influencing Apple in this direction. And I'm very curious to hear, John, what's your opinion on declarative UI frameworks? Do you have any experience with them?
Yeah, you could say so.
Okay, so tell me about it.
Sure. So, first of all, like, this is a super interesting topic, and I am pleased to hear, if this is indeed true, that Apple is moving in this direction. Because declarative programming in general has some really nice benefits, and when done on like the system level, instead of just being like a layer on top of the system, it can generate some really nice APIs that generates code that is very, very easy to read. So just very quickly before I talk about my kind of history with it, just to kind of recap a little bit what declarative programming, what we mean when we're talking about that. So like you mentioned, Guy, is that instead of kind of specifying things like line by line, you create a button object, you set the background color, you set the position like line by line, and you know, you execute that code from top to bottom, you instead kind of define the rules of your system, or in this case, the UI, and you say, you know, I want the UI to look like this, and I want to define these rules, like if there is a button inside of this part of the app, it should look like this. If it's a text field that is positioned like this, then it should have this size. And then the system can just look at those rules and apply them, and from those rules decide what the actual UI will end up looking like. So the reason that is very nice is because it enables a lot of reuse of code, and it enables you to have like this single source of truth where you have like all the rules that apply to your UI in this case, and then you can just very, very easily create new UIs without having to code them from scratch. So I've been working with this for quite a while. When I was working at Spotify, one of the main things I did was being the lead developer of a project called the Hub Framework. And this is something that we ended up open sourcing. It is currently actually deprecated. I think Spotify has, you know, like many big companies, they're continuing to move on to new things and evolve things. And I guess, you know, the current solution is not, you know, open source, but we'll put a link in the show notes to the version I worked on, which is still up on GitHub, although it's deprecated. But the idea behind that framework was that to enable the Spotify app to actually render its content based on what the backend or the server gives it. So instead of, you know, building all these UIs again from scratch, you know, saying, you know, here's the playlist screen with these exactly defined, you know, here's, there should be a button here, there should be a list of items here, or here's the profile view and it should have a header here and cards here. Instead of having all that logic specifically tied to each screen, what we would instead do is have the backend actually send not only the data, not only the actual content like titles and subtitles, but also send like the layout configuration to say, first there should be a header here, then there should be a carousel, then should be a list item, then another list item, etc. And these type of like declarative UIs give you a lot of freedom, because you can just end up changing the UI, you know, pretty much whenever you want, and the app just adapts to it. It doesn't have to be, you know, reworked, it doesn't have to be changed, you don't have to rewrite all the code. You just update the configuration and it kind of just works. It's very similar actually in terms of the idea to what we talked about earlier with the appearance and with asset catalogs, in that you just declare the content you want and then the rules decide how that's being displayed.
Most content in apps currently is dynamic.
Yeah, so absolutely.
You get something from a server, which could be user content. So let's use Apple News, the news app, as an example. Mm-hmm. The news is content, and the app is programmed to display that content in a specific way. So I have a news story, and it has a picture, a title, and a subtitle, and that's it. The content itself, so what the server gives the app, can't change the structure of the content. It can only change the content itself within the structure that's already defined. And what John is explaining with the Hub framework and declarative stuff, like he said, the structure of the content itself could be changed, not only what's inside the existing structure. So the server could define a completely new type of news story that doesn't have just a title and a picture. Maybe it has a title and a video player and a subtitle. So that's the difference between just changing the content and changing structure.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what makes declarative programming in general so nice, because you end up with a lot of flexibility. And let's say now Apple is moving in this direction, you know, if they are inspired by, you know, something like React, which works in, by and large, in very similar fashions, where instead of, you know, building up your UI line by line, like we talked about, you are just asked to render your components. So let's say you have a header component that just gets sent a render call, and it contains like the data it should render, and it just returns the state of the UI for that data. So if you think about it, what actually ends up happening is that you have what we refer to as like a pure function, pretty much, where you have just input and output, no side effects. So your UI kind of becomes a function of your state. So when you're changing the state, like if you have a to-do app and you add a new item to your to-do list, the state is changed and the UI is re-rendered. And you don't have to maintain that logic yourself in your own code. The framework can handle that for you. And if this would be done on the system level, we could do something like, you know, change the data, and then the framework would just go in, look at the rules we have defined for the UI, and render it accordingly.
Very cool. So so you actually like this approach, just to be clear?
Yes, I do. I do like this approach. It comes with more complexity, again, when it's done like as a layer on top of the system, because it feels like every step of the way you're kind of fighting the system a little bit, because the system was not designed to work this way. But if Apple would actually build something like this into UIKit or as a new framework, and it would be integrated into the system, I think it could be very, very nice.
The reason I don't use much of all of this cool stuff on my own projects is because you end up depending on a third party, and like the hub framework, it's already deprecated. So
yeah, it's a proof of point.
Yeah, it's probably not maintained anymore. So if I had written an app using the hub framework back when it was first released, I would have to either maintain it myself or migrate it to something else or keep using like a deprecated thing.
Yeah.
And that's true for most of these cool things that completely change the structure of how you write your app. So I avoid those as much as possible, and I try to stick with Apple's recommended approach with some sugar on top just to make it a little bit better.
A little bit sweeter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. But I agree. If Apple had something that's super integrated with the system and maybe the developer tools that use this approach, I think I would love to use it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we should also mention this very interesting Mark Gurman tweet. He mentioned that this initiative likely intends to replace NIP files. So NIP files are interface files. You can think of them as like HTML, basically, but that's not what they are. They are binary files. But they are those files created using Interface Builder, the current drag and drop thing. And this is something that's tricky. You always have to explain to new iOS or Mac developers, because many people think of Interface Builder as, oh, it's generating code. And that's not what it's doing. It's basically freeze-drying objects so they can be brought back to life when the app is running. That's what happens, basically. And Gurman says that the initiative likely intends to replace NIP files with Swift linked to Interface Builder, which could allow developers to declare the UIs by hand or by using the existing visual tools.
Yeah.
And then he compares it to XAML on Windows, which mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, I've used that a little bit when I was back in a previous life when I was doing lots of Windows and development for Microsoft platforms.
Wow.
This is interesting because, you know, for anyone who's used Interface Builder in Swift, you have to... So basically in Swift, for those of you who are not programmers who are continuing to listen to this, because thank you.
And sorry, by the way.
Yeah. In Swift, you have this concept of optionality, which means that a variable can either be optional or required. And if you want something that is optional, every time you're going to use it, you need to basically check if it's there. So if you've used other languages like Java, that would be the equivalent of like a null check, but it's like,
and if you don't check and it's not there, your app will crash, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So whenever you're using anything from Interface Builder in Swift, you basically have to have them as optionals, because you know, the system can't guarantee when the app is compiled that the object will actually be there, because it's loaded at runtime. And that makes for some, you know, not very nice code, or it doesn't feel, you know, completely at home in Swift. So something like this could definitely help in order to make something, you know, like you mentioned, you know, you could have Interface Builder instead generate something that Swift could load directly at compile time or check with a compiler, and have that be more type safe and have that actually be guaranteed at compile time to link together.
Yeah, I even think about like transitioning Interface Builder to be like a Swift code generator of sorts. Maybe something to do with playgrounds as well. What I imagine was like a visual editor on one side of the screen and a code editor on the other side, and I change something in the visual editor and it updates the code. And if I change the code, it updates the visual editor.
That would actually be very similar to how it works on Android, because on Android, what you have is you have these XML-based layout files, and you can actually edit Interface Builder now since, I don't know, a few Xcode versions back using XML as well. So they're XML.
Kinda.
Yeah, kind of. they're kind of XML-based now as well. But on Android, you have like a, you know, you have an XML file, and you can then have a code like interface to that as well. You can have a visual interface to that as well. So if you are changing the layout of a button, for example, in the visual and their equivalent of Interface Builder, that would also update the XML file as well. So it could work similar to that, but with actual compiled Swift code.
Yeah, and they could pair this with some sort of live reload feature. And
oh yeah, that would
be
awesome.
I would be very happy.
Yes, there are so many opportunities here, and I guess it would require, you know, if this was actually integrated into the compiler, into the Swift compiler, it would require some major changes to how the compiler works, because it doesn't at the moment support hot reloading or loading code bundles at runtime, which Objective-C did.
There's an issue with iOS devices as well because of code signing.
Yeah.
But that could be like an entitlement that gets added to debug apps which you're using and you're signing. So they can definitely solve it. I think there's some way to solve that.
Yeah, and also declarative UIs in general actually play very nicely into this. So like I mentioned earlier, if your UI is a function of your state, all you need to do to change your UI is to update your state. So if you want to have hot reloading, you can actually do a lot of hot reloading-like things at runtime anyway, because you're just changing the state, and that way the UI changes.
Very cool. And do we think this new declarative UI project has something to do with the cross-platform aspect?
I think it might, because if you think about it, if you are just defining the rules, then the system can interpret those rules differently on different platforms. So, you know, right now, when we were talking about Marzipan earlier, we said, you know, it would be challenging because how would you define, like, menu bars? How would you define different differences in navigation? And sure, declarative UIs doesn't solve all of those problems, but it makes it easier because if you're just defining the rules of how your UI will be rendered, then the Mac and the iOS versions of the framework can interpret those rules differently.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It could work on top of UIKit and AppKit at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's the main goal, because I started to believe, because I believed this before, but then the whole Marzipan thing happened. But I'm a believer now that Apple doesn't believe in cross-platform UIs, and they don't believe in merging the systems.
Right. We even had a statement from Tim Cook. I think it was like he was in Australia giving an interview or something like that. And it came up like a question about should the Mac and iPad platforms be merged? And the result or the answer was basically, yeah, the no, because it would result in too many compromises. And this is something that Apple has reiterated many, many times over the last couple of years when people have, you know, ask something like this, whether the iPad and the Mac will eventually be merged. So yeah, I don't know either if it's something that they keep as a priority. But, you know, we've mentioned also previous that both iOS and the Mac share a lot of things in the foundation. And this kind of declarative UI layer could just be seen as another one of those foundational building blocks.
Yeah. Yeah. And another aspect is that I've basically heard from people at Apple, the famous little birdies, that
yeah,
they really, as an organization, don't believe in merging the platforms, and that they have tried cross UI frameworks and they have seen that it doesn't work in practice, basically.
Right. Yeah, we've heard a lot of that in the past. But again, I feel like we're talking about different things when we're talking about, you know, should the tech be shared or should the frameworks be shared or should like the user experiences be the same? Because I find it hard to believe also that Apple could right now merge the user experiences because they're so different, but the tech could be shared.
Yeah, and this declarative UI framework is definitely a part of that.
Yeah, it absolutely.
Be shared easily for the user, and they could do the hard part of translating between the declarative thing and UIKit on iOS and tvOS and the declarative thing and AppKit on the Mac.
Another aspect of this that we've also talked about a little bit before is, you know, some of the reasons why something like this might be appealing to Apple, and that's to enable more people who work on iOS to do work on the Mac as well. So, Yugi, you've done, you know, quite a lot of work on the Mac. I've done a little bit, but you've done a lot more. And Brad Simmons, he wrote a very nice little short post entitled "You're Practically a Mac Developer," which is just, you know, set out to convince people that, you know what, it's not so different actually already. If you want to start doing Mac development and you already know iOS, it's not that big of a deal. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on this, like as someone who has worked a lot on iOS and a lot on the Mac, why do you think Mac development is kind of looked at as being so hard, so inaccessible? And do you think, you know, the reason Apple might be doing something like this might be to change that?
I'm not really sure why people find Mac development to be so hard, but I think the main reason could be because it's different. Maybe some people, when they are iOS developers and they have been iOS developers for a long time, they expect that they're going to move to the Mac and it's going to be very easy because they already do this iOS thing, which is very similar. And it is similar, but it has enough differences that you have to learn stuff to actually be a good Mac developer, even when you are already a very good iOS developer. But I agree with what Brent wrote about an iOS developer being practically a Mac developer, because when you think about all of the stuff you have to deal with on iOS, most of that stuff is the same on the Mac. The, like, all of the networking code and your models and persistence, whether you're using the file system or core data, it's all exactly the same. And there's only this little layer on top, which is the UI, which changes. And even there are many similarities. So I think the reason people think it's so hard, it's because they expect it to be seamless. Like, I won't have to learn anything. And then when they notice that it's not so seamless, it's like, oh my God, this is the hardest thing in the world.
I think one big reason for this as well is that I think if you're starting out with a new app from scratch, then yes, Mac development, I don't think, is much harder than iOS development. I think it's, you know, very similar. There's a lot of underlying technologies that are the same. You're using the same, you know, Swift standard library, and all the things that are not related to the UI are similar or exactly the same. But I think a big reason why a lot of people have this kind of look at Mac development is if you've ever tried to actually just port an iOS app to the Mac, and you realize that, you know, it's a huge thing and it's really, really hard to do for most apps. So why is that? Well, in one word, I think it's a lot because of our UI view controllers, or our use of UI view controllers. So on iOS, there's this class called UI view controller, and it's basically what we use to render a part of the UI. And it's a controller that acts, you know, it manages the UI and it acts as kind of the center point for a lot of different things. And the problem is that most iOS apps put so much of the logic and so much of the actual things that the app should do inside of the UI view controllers. So if you then try to move your app to the Mac, but all of your logic is actually very, very tightly coupled with your UI, and you can't move the UI, well, you end up not being able to move anything at all. So I think that's a kind of big problem. And I think if iOS apps in general were more written in a decoupled way, and some are, but if in general that was an approach we were taking as a community, porting to the Mac would be just like you said, just swap out the UI part and you're done. But in reality, that's most likely not the case.
Yeah, I agree. And I have to share as well my experience. I started with Mac development, and when I started working with iOS more seriously, it was a huge challenge for me, like maybe the same or even worse than what people report when moving from iOS to the Mac, because now I have to worry about battery life and I can't use too much memory or CPU because the app is going to be killed, and what happens when the person locks the device, and what happens if a phone call comes in and if the person rotates the device. Like there are so many things you have to worry about on iOS that are simply non-existent on the Mac. And for me, moving from Mac to iOS, it was really overwhelming.
Yeah, I can imagine. iOS definitely like puts a lot of new constraints, and in many ways, you know, iOS is like a new take on Mac development, if you will. Like the Mac APIs were obviously designed like 10 years before, so Apple learned a lot and applied a lot of more modern kind of practices. So going to iOS from the Mac, I can imagine you would encounter a lot of new things that you, like you mentioned, that you wouldn't need to handle before. And the same thing goes from going from iOS to the Mac. You kind of, you know, in some aspects, you have to step back in time a little bit and use APIs that use some kind of older conventions.
Yeah, like one example I remember was like trying to set the title of a button on iOS. And it was like once or twice I had this issue. I just wanted to set the title property on the button, but on iOS you have to actually call a method called setTitle. And you have to pass a state. So that's complicated.
Yeah,
on the Mac,
exactly.
You just set the title. I don't know if the name, I think it's string value or something. So it's also tricky. But anyway, for me, moving from the Mac to iOS, it was a shock. Like, how, what? I have to call this method? And what's a state? Which state should I put in here? So, I think it's the issue people have with I'm an expert on something and I'm going to do something different that I have to basically start from scratch. Except you're not starting from scratch because you're practically a Mac developer.
Yeah, but then again, I think that this, like, these compatibility things are what makes, you know, most of us kind of look at, and most of us being iOS developers, look at Mac development this way. So, and you can just compare it to, for example, tvOS, which, where you don't really have this problem because you have your UI view controller can actually run on tvOS with very, very little modification in most cases. So, and there, you know, you have people porting their apps from iOS to tvOS in, you know, very little time. But on the Mac, you have to have this decoupling. And like you also mentioned, you have to reset your brain a little bit to say, okay, I'm going to a different platform now. Even though I can bring a lot of my code if it's decoupled, I need to just, you know, have a different expectations or reset my expectations and not assume that everything will be exactly the same. So now when people are hearing this, maybe some people out there are feeling, you know what, this sounds pretty good. Maybe I should actually give Mac development a new chance. Maybe I should learn AppKit. So you, Rambo, you actually started a website a couple of months back called learnappkit.io, which currently only contains a form where people can sign up to learn AppKit. So what happened with that?
Well, many people have been asking. I launched this landing page quite a while ago, And the idea is to create content specifically for iOS developers that want to port their apps to the Mac. So that's a very focused thing that I want to do. It's not like a generic app kit or Swift course for new people who want to start making Mac apps. It's specifically for iOS developers. And I decided to wait until after WWDC. The whole Marzipan thing was too hot to ignore. And I thought, what if I release a lot of content and then WWDC comes and it's basically all deprecated immediately? So I decided to wait until after WWDC. And I'm not even sure what the format's going to be. I was thinking about doing videos, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But if you're interested in learning, if you're an iOS developer and you're interested in learning about AppKit and the differences between UIKit and AppKit and a basic guide on how to port your iOS app to the Mac, go to learnappkit.io and sign up, and you'll be notified when that goes live.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. I really, really like that you're doing this, and this initiative is really cool. So let's see what WWDC brings and whether or not you will base it on the current stuff or if it will be something new and shiny. But something I think we actually didn't mention when we talked about this new information that has been released on Daring Fireball, or these new rumors, is that apparently this, whatever it is, Marzipan or whatever the name is, won't debut at WWDC this year.
Yeah, it's set to be released on WWDC 2019, so only next year. And that makes a lot of sense. Like this year, we expect to be a more stability and just evolution focused year. So maybe we'll get new frameworks and new capabilities. And of course, we're going to get new devices at the end of the year. But it's not going to be like a huge change to iOS or the Mac as we know them now. That's coming next year, 2019, with iOS 13, which is probably going to have a UI refresh.
Yeah. And Apple does this a lot. They do these like controlled leaks where they will, you know, have some little birdies fly out from Apple HQ into different blogs and different parts of the web and tell these little stories. And we've seen this in the past with several different things. And this year we've heard things like, well, it's going to be a more slow year. We're going to focus on stability and bug fixing. And now we have this leak as well, which, you know, really seems like something that is, you know, originally kind of controlled by Apple, like to set the right expectations for WWDC.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure someone contacted John Gruber and gave him this information just to control expectations, because this was being talked about too much and with too many expectations for this year, and they have to control expectations so people don't get very disappointed.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he got a phone call and it was one of these voices, you know, that they use when they want to anonymize people, like, you know, whistleblowers or something, when there's like these weird anonymized voices.
But it was actually Craig Federighi holding like a fan to the microphone to start his voice.
I'm sure that's what happened.
Yeah, probably.
Awesome. All right, that's all the topics we wanted to talk about on this episode. Again, we would love to see you support us on Patreon in order to bring you this show every week. That would mean that we would have a new episode next week instead of what it is now, which, you know, next episode will be in 2 weeks. So head over to patreon.com/stacktracepod if you're interested in helping us out on this journey. But that's it for this episode. So if you want to find out more about us and what we do, you can head to stacktracepodcast.fm. You can find us at StackTracePod on Twitter. And you can find Rambo at _inside and me at John Sundell on Twitter as well. But that's it for this episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.